I think that it was actually the natural reaction to what has been a broken system for so long, because we layered on top of previous technologies that at some point didn't work anymore.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. This episode, I'm joined by Max Waddington and very special guest, Natalie Brunel. Today, we're going to dive into Natalie's recent book, Bitcoin is for Everyone, and talk about how cryptocurrency and Bitcoin is transforming both individual financial journeys and economic systems worldwide. But before we dive in, Natalie, could you just give us a brief intro? You know, there's a lot to cover here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. That's right. I recently wrote Bitcoin is for Everyone. I also host a podcast called Coin Stories, where I interview thought leaders in the space, people that are for Bitcoin, also against Bitcoin. We cover what's happening in the economy. And before my work in Bitcoin, I was actually a TV journalist for more than 10 years, doing mostly investigative work. I really wanted to pursue and root out public corruption and hold the powerful accountable. And there's a lot of crossover there with Bitcoin. So, I love what I do. I'm so grateful. And I just want to educate the world on Bitcoin.
Amazing. Well, thank you for joining us today. And actually, you were just at the Bitcoin 2026 conference.
That's right.
You know, Max and I could cover the news, but I think maybe you have a more on the ground perspective of what's going on. What was the conference like? How was it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I love this conference every single year. It was my sixth one. Time really flies. My first was back in 2021, where I had barely any followers. And I had just started my journey into Bitcoin and started my podcast. And now here I am. And I've had the chance to release my book. I got to interview lots of folks on stage. And the focus, I think, this year was really on the institutional wave, the institutional adoption of Bitcoin. I think trillions of dollars are going to flow into this asset class. And it was great to hear from all the companies that are working really hard to build in the space, even though we are technically in a bear market. There's always just such a great vibe there with people coming together in person. So many of us live far away because it's not only a decentralized money and network, but we're decentralized. And so it's nice to come together in one place and meet and hang out and talk about the future of Bitcoin.
Well, that's great. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today. But could you talk a little bit about your journey into Bitcoin and Bitcoin education? Like what inspired you to go from TV journalism to focusing on Bitcoin?
So I really didn't understand money and I didn't know it until someone gave me my first Bitcoin book. I read it highly skeptical. I had started to invest in Bitcoin around 2017 when it went from 3,000 to 20,000 and then crashed back to 3,000. I was like, what is this thing? But so many people were excited about it. And I, at that time, really looked at it from the frame of mind of more of a speculative investment. I thought, okay, anything I put in this, I'm probably going to lose. It's digital, so it can be hacked. And that was because not only did I not understand Bitcoin, but I really didn't understand money itself as a technology. And so when I started to learn about Bitcoin, it took me down a really, really rich and fulfilling path of learning about economics, different economic theories, the history of money, why our purchasing power keeps decreasing while the supply of money keeps increasing, and what that means for all of us. And for me, it was like a huge wake-up moment, because one thing that I had been reporting on and noticing is that everybody feels like they're working so hard and playing by all the rules, but they're not getting further ahead. In fact, they feel like they're kind of on a treadmill or falling behind. And so something feels really broken. People are having a hard time saving for the future, saving for retirement, affording education. And I think with that comes more of a loss of hope, a loss of the belief that the American dream dream is still within reach, and that has consequences in society. And so I wondered, well, what happened here? And that's the first question I think people should ask, is why is this happening? And that's what my book tries to address, because there is a reason for it. And once you start going down that journey of learning about money and learning about Bitcoin, you realize that there is a solution. There are solutions that we can embrace that are neutral, that are positive, that can bring about more opportunity and abundance, and a more fair system for all of us. And so that's what gets me so excited, because I felt like not only did I find something that explained why things were so broken, but it gave me hope for the future that we can actually fix those things.
That's a tremendously warm message. I think not only the data would show and support the idea of this, you know, K-shaped style economy, but you can just feel it, right, when talking to people, whether it is at a conference or around work, right? It's definitely something tangible. And yet, I still kind of run into this barrier with a lot of folks, maybe even in that exact situation, where it's just so much work to learn about Bitcoin, not only from an economic lens, but also the engineering side, because it is digital. So can you maybe talk about why your book is unique in that way, and what, like, maybe who it's for and what you're hoping to accomplish with this specifically?
Yeah, when I looked out at the landscape of different books in this space, I felt like there was really nothing for my girlfriends or for my mom, nothing for people in my audience who were like me and had zero background in finance, computer science, and engineering, and who were also busy juggling a job and kids and a 401k that they may not fully understand. And maybe they just wanted to know, why should I care about this? So I wanted to make Bitcoin is for Everyone a very simple and accessible introduction to the problem, which is that our money is broken, and one of the best solutions that I think exists, which is Bitcoin. And what I found along the way of that whole journey is just how universal the experience of broken money is, and that there is a real human cost to the instability of our financial system. And you can feel it whether you're wealthy and sort of winning in this system, or if you're among the tens of millions of people who are struggling financially and everything in between. Because one of the messages I make clear in the book is that, okay, let's say you are winning, you don't want to live in a world that is filled with people who are so frustrated, right? And coming together saying, we want to burn this system down because they feel like they're so far behind. And if you're one of the people who's so far behind, you're constantly stressed. You can't make ends meet. So, you know, both sides of the equation and of that K-shaped economy live in an increasingly unstable and chaotic situation. And we need to drive at the heart of what's causing it so we can actually fix it.
Okay. So I think a lot of people listening and generally would agree that the money is broken. A lot of my clients in particular will, you know, like a common retort I'll hear to the Bitcoin thesis is, you know, you can just invest in gold or invest in something else. Like, why Bitcoin? Why is it so important? And kind of what is the unlock here and that's driven you to write this book?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin is just so special because it carries all the best properties that a money could have, but in digital form. And that's important because we live in an interconnected world. We communicate digitally. We're hosting this webinar digitally. We need to send money across borders, whether that's across states or globally. And we need the least friction possible. And I think we take for granted, you know, if we swipe our credit card to buy our coffee, it seems really simple and the money seems like it settles instantly, but it actually doesn't. Behind the scenes, there is a lot going on. And it's very complex. It's very opaque. There are a lot of banks changing hands. There are people taking cuts along the way. People are surveilling everything you do. So we don't really think about that when we make simple payments. And then when we think of money as a store of value, well, I mean, the data and your real life experience on the ground reveals the truth, which is that people are working hard, but feeling like they can't afford what they once could. A single, you know, middle class household used to be able to purchase a house on one income, and now it takes two and maybe a couple side hustles. And so something has drastically changed with our ability to actually use money as a savings vehicle. And so Bitcoin addresses that as well. And so it's this amazing combination of different properties, and you have this powerful monetary network that connects all of us and allows us to transact value globally, and it's accessible to anyone in the world, but also as a store of value because it has a finite cap of 21 million, it allows you to save in something that can't be inflated or debased. And I'm sure we'll go into more of these properties in our conversation, but those two aspects are so important: Bitcoin the asset and Bitcoin the network.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you even framed that conversation from, you know, a very US-based perspective, right? We're all based in the US. We live in a relatively unrestricted system. But how does this play out in a system where money is much more restricted, right? Like, you may not be able to access US dollars or other forms of currency.
Yeah, no, I agree. So Bitcoin absolutely matters at the individual level. And that goes for both Americans as well as people living in more unstable and restrictive regimes and systems. For most of history, like, if you wanted to save, your main options were in physical things, right? Gold or land, real estate. They can be taken from you. Some of them can be lost or confiscated when you cross a border. And then we evolved to having paper money, which was very easy to carry around, but paper money relies on trust. You have to trust whoever is printing it, which means the governments, not to print too much and dilute the value. And so for people in stable countries, I think that, paper money like the dollar has worked for the most part. But for people in places like Argentina, Lebanon, Nigeria, Venezuela, Turkey, it's been really devastating. They've had inflation rates of more than 100%. They've had hyperinflation. I'm sure people might be familiar with those images of people literally carrying wheelbarrows of cash, the bolivar, because it inflated so much that it absolutely destroyed the purchasing power. Many of us were taught in our history classes about Weimar Germany and the hyperinflation they experienced after the World War. And I think that those things, we don't think about, because here in the US, the dollar has been so stable for so long. But look at the purchasing power. I mean, the purchasing power since the Federal Reserve was established, our central bank, in 1913, has been destroyed by 99%. And even just since COVID, 40% of the dollars in existence today were printed in response to the pandemic and the economic stimulus that we had to do in order to keep our economy functioning. That destroyed so much purchasing power. And so I think the average person is really struggling. And that's why we've seen this massive chasm now between the haves and the have-nots, and this wealth gap, that K-shaped economy we were talking about earlier. The folks with assets have really benefited from the inflation. Everyone who works for a wage has been at a great disadvantage. And of course, that makes people frustrated and look for political solutions. But I think that if we address the money side of it, the thing that that allows you to save for the future in a way that no one can dilute, no one can debase, that brings about more chances for the average person to once again catch up. And one story that I actually share in the book, again, is it's an international story. It's Roya Maboub, who was an entrepreneur in Afghanistan. And she started paying young women to write blog posts in Bitcoin, because most of these women weren't allowed to have bank accounts. A lot of them, they actually had to have permission from either fathers or husbands in order to bank. And so she paid them in Bitcoin. And when the Taliban came back into Afghanistan in 2021 and the banks effectively shut their doors, they had a tool and a way to help their families escape. And Bitcoin was so much more than just a savings vehicle. It was a tool for freedom and empowerment. Those who had it were able to do something that those who didn't have it weren't. And so I think that there are so many aspects to Bitcoin that are so, so, so important. And again, in America, we focus more on the store of value, but globally and in these unstable regimes, it's much more of a freedom and human rights tool.
Right. I mean, I think that describes everything perfectly, because we're not just talking about store of value here. We're also talking about censorship resistance, which is a key property of Bitcoin, which I think is a hard topic to communicate to US-based individuals, right? We're not used to facing this type of problem, but it does still show up.
I was going to say something I always hear specifically from US-based investors, typically they'll skew a little older, is the fact that they view it as a bug, that you can't hold Bitcoin. That's something my grandma has told me time and time again. She asks me specifically, when am I going to be able to hold the Bitcoin? And that's kind of her limiting factor, just these limiting beliefs. But I think, Natalie, you do a really good job on basically flipping that on its head and showing how this digital nature is really a security feature, right? It can be very powerful for everyone else that, you know, might need it, aside from those that have these limiting beliefs based on how, you know, personal experiences, right?
Yeah. And I relate to that because my mom is very much someone who wants something physical and tangible. She came from a communist country. I share a bit of that in Bitcoin is for Everyone. And she knows what it's like for there to be like a very oppressive regime where there's no sense of economic mobility. You basically have to wait in lines for basic necessities. And so you don't have a lot of economic freedom. And with Bitcoin, for the first time in history, an ordinary person can hold their savings, can hold the fruits of their labor, what they worked so hard for, without a bank, without a government, without anyone's permission, basically using just a phrase that they memorized. And what's important about that with what happened with my parents is if you needed to flee, if you needed to flee a regime or something really broke down and you needed to get your family outside, you can't bring gold bars with you. And so I know that, you know, some folks, especially in older generations, maybe they cling on to the fact that something is physical, but actually digital, a digital form of money that you can store with you, that you can take anywhere around the world, carries such value. And people in real time, billions of people who live in these authoritarian regimes, they can't flee with gold. They can't flee with their land. And I think that this huge shift is happening because Bitcoin really is empowering those who have the least power in the system. And as for the tamper resistance that you mentioned and the censorship resistance, I think that that's so important too. And just to kind of drill in on that, it just means that the record of Bitcoin, the digital record, it can't be rewritten. Once a Bitcoin transaction is in the ledger, no one can go back in and change it. And the whole network is constantly verifying and checking and reinforcing that history. So altering the past is essentially impossible. So it serves as this truth record. And the censorship resistant means that no one can stop anyone from using it. Not a government, not a bank, not even the people who helped build the code for Bitcoin. There's no central office. There's no on or off switch. There's no central bank. So again, maybe for a US audience, some of these properties can feel more abstract because they've never had to flee and use a different form of money. But I think it does matter to so many people around the world. And there are so many stories that we've heard even in the last few years about people's bank accounts being frozen or payment processors cutting off legal businesses. We had Operation Choke Point 2.0. Ordinary people can get caught up in these things anywhere in the world. So I think censorship resistance, it's not just a hypothetical. It's really an insurance policy to make sure that you have the money when you need it most.
Yeah, I think that's great, right? Like the common theme is, oh, it's never going to happen to me until it does, which is why that is so important. Now, we've talked a lot about inflation and the feeling of being on a treadmill in the US. Can you maybe dive into, like, say I don't know anything about economics or inflation? How am I seeing inflation in my daily life? What is changing around me, and how can people get a grasp on that topic?
Yeah, so you know, I feel like half of my book is really explaining inflation. The first half isn't even about Bitcoin. Most people feel inflation before they can even name it. And part of that feeling is that you're doing everything right, you're following all the rules, and you're still falling behind economically. So maybe you're looking at your grocery bill and thinking, huh, this, you know, this used to cost $80 and now it's $140. But I'm not making that much more. And it really hits the hardest in all these things that we can't avoid. I think Lynn Alden called it the basket of the American dream. It's your food, your gas, your rent, your housing. And really, I mean, forget even buying a home because affordability has crashed to such crazy levels. And I think also healthcare and education, like these are those big ticket items that you can't cut out of your life. And wages, they might have ticked up a little bit on paper, but they're not keeping up with the cost of living. They're not keeping up with the cost of the American dream basket. So I think that we feel inflation, but we don't understand what's causing it. And what I try to share in the book is that if you look at our money supply, if you look at what's actually happening at the core of the system, we are creating far more money than even inflation numbers are capturing it. So we have a target rate of 2% inflation, which, by the way, means that your money will be diluted by 2% every single year. So you have to make at least 2% just to be staying in the same place. You need like a 4% raise in order to get, you know, 2%. And so I think people don't realize that. Meanwhile, they're expanding the money supply by an average of 7 to 8%. So we're all sort of drowning. And it's understandable why we've been led to basically invest our money. We can't save our money in cash. We have to find assets that beat the rate of inflation. We have to become, you know, real estate owners or landlords or traders. And I think for the average person, that starts to become overwhelming, right? Like if you went to school to study to become a doctor or maybe you're a hairdresser or you run a construction company, why do you also have to become a stock expert? Why do you also have to, you know, find enough to buy a second property to rent out as an Airbnb? Something is fundamentally broken, and it's because inflation at the end of the day, it destroys our purchasing power, and it puts us all on this treadmill where if they're inflating the rate of the money supply faster than any of our wages and incomes, then we're all sort of in this losing battle. And I think that once people start to grasp that, they can become empowered about what to do about it, which is to invest and to accumulate assets. And my argument is that Bitcoin is the best asset to have in your portfolio.
I think you mentioned Lynn Alden. Lynn Alden did some really good work with Sam Callahan, who you're familiar with, a little while back. And their argument, it was pretty data-driven, showed a lot of Bitcoin's returns over time, its behavior can be attributed to changes in money supply and liquidity, right? So the vast majority of Bitcoin's moves can be explained by this kind of one phenomenon. Would you make the argument that if money printing and the inflation and the economic system we live in today, if that wasn't so broken, Bitcoin might be less valuable, or would it be just as valuable? And can you maybe paint a picture of how you see the future of money printing proceeding? Do you think we'll get our act together anytime soon here?
Well, I think Bitcoin is perfect money in terms of its properties, its portability, its saleability, its divisibility. I mean, all of the properties that I go over in my book that make for good money, you can find in Bitcoin. It was engineered basically to be the most ideal form of money. And the most important traits to me are, again, the scarcity of it, the fact that it's 21 million coins, it can never be diluted. And that you have this decentralized network that creates a security barrier, because there is no issuer, there's no government to provide that security. It's really just like a consensus-based decentralized system that allows us all to verify in real time. And so I think that it was actually the natural reaction to what has been a broken system for so long, because we layered on top of previous technologies that, you know, at some point didn't work anymore. And I think the best technology for money that came before Bitcoin was gold, but gold's inherent flaw is that it's physical. So it's very difficult to transport and settle over long distances as you scale economies. So on top of that, in order to fix that issue, we papered over it, right? We abstracted gold and we made it into a system of claims. First paper claims, physically paper, and now digital claims. But at the end of the day, when you can just expand those claims and you go further and further into debt, which, you know, to Lynn's point that nothing stops this train, then you have a system that's really like a house of cards, because you have far more claims than you have actual real money. There's nothing really backing it anymore. I mean, one of the things that both Lynn and I have pointed out in our educational work is that there's very few reserves that actually back any of the money that we have in circulation. Even Satoshi pointed that out as being the cause of these waves, the credit bubbles that we see that eventually collapse. And that's not sustainable. And so Bitcoin, I think, imposes real like consequences again into this system, because money shouldn't be just something we could print. And when you do print it, it gets funneled into the economy through certain channels, which I explain in Bitcoin is for everyone. And there are certain classes of people, groups, individuals who tremendously benefit from being first in line to the money printer. It's called the Cantillon effect. But everyone else is downstream. And guess what? The majority of people are downstream and are just working harder for money that's actually worth less. So we needed something like Bitcoin, especially in a world where we're digitally connected, where the economy is global and complex. We needed a form of money that connects all of us to a source of truth that no one can control, no one can inflate, no one can manipulate. And so, yes, of course, in the fiat system, as they continue to print the dollar, those dollars have to flow somewhere. And some of that will go into Bitcoin. But ultimately, I think it's kind of going to be over the long run, a transition for us to eventually have Bitcoin underpinning the entire global financial system. And that's a ways away. So I don't want anyone to listen to that and think, oh my gosh, the dollar's collapsing. I'm absolutely not saying that. I just think over time, we're going to see more of a diversification. We're already seeing central banks sort of take a step back and allocate more to gold as far as their central bank reserves. It used to be US treasuries that were the number one reserve asset for central banks. Now they're shifting back to gold. I think eventually that will compete with Bitcoin. So we're seeing a shifting globally of the financial system, and we shouldn't be surprised, because over history, when you've looked at reserve currencies and their trajectories and their paths, most of them did not last longer than 100 years. And we're already over 100 years for the US dollar. So I think it's natural to expect that there's going to be some changes. And I think that Bitcoin is something that every individual, corporation, nation state, central bank will hold.
Yeah, I think that's really great. And you made some really great points there. And we're talking, you know, at a very macro scale right now, right? We're talking central banks, we're talking corporations. But I'm curious, you've been in the Bitcoin education space since 2021. How have you seen individual adoption practices change? What are the patterns? And what are you hearing in conversations with folks when you talk to them about Bitcoin that's maybe different from 2021 and maybe the same?
I mean, it's changing so quickly. In 2024, when I went to the Bitcoin conference, we were leading up to a very contentious US election again. And we had a presidential candidate come to the conference. And now we have an administration that for the most part is extremely favorable to Bitcoin, has established a strategic Bitcoin reserve. We had a US senator introduce the Bitcoin Act, which not only talks about keeping the Bitcoin, not selling it, but also accumulating a 1 million Bitcoin over the next 5 years. So just to even have these conversations at those levels and roles of power in the government is really remarkable, because we're only less than 20 years into a brand new asset. We had a 4-star admiral in the US Navy talk about Bitcoin as a strategic asset for national security and reveal that the US is running a Bitcoin node. I mean, these are types of things that I think we didn't expect to happen so quickly, and not to mention the institutional adoption. I mean, Fidelity has been a pioneer and a leader in this way. It was one of the first companies to mine Bitcoin, to introduce Bitcoin products to its customers, the ETF that was introduced and finally approved in 2024. Now we have more and more companies and banks, not just embracing Bitcoin, offering it to their customers, but actually adding it to their treasury reserves. We have over 100 public companies that have Bitcoin treasuries. We have companies like Strategy that are issuing innovative instruments like digital credit. This is starting to move very, very quickly. And I think while it's exciting that the institutional side is really jumping in, I also just want to make sure that the average individual understands this technology and finds, motivation to learn about it and to take self-custody, because it is such a powerful tool, again, to be your own bank and be truly financially financially sovereign. And so it's great that we have more of these on-ramps, but Bitcoin allows you to be financially sovereign for the first time. And so I hope people learn to embrace it as more on-ramps develop.
Well, I couldn't have said that better myself. We are just about at time here, but I was going to ask you, how is Bitcoin actually for everyone? But I think you just answered that question. I think you beat me to it. So Natalie, thank you so much for joining us today. Max, thank you for a great conversation. With Mother's Day coming up, it's a good reminder that conversations about money and finance often start at home and across generations. Natalie, your book expands on a lot of what we discussed today. For those who want to explore these ideas further, it's a great resource. Thanks again to both of you, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.